Hey folks, thank you for coming to the coming civil war over general purpose computing, the sequel to this talk I gave last year at 28C3 in Berlin, the coming war on general purpose computing. In a nutshell, the hypothesis of that talk was that computers and the internet are everywhere. The world is increasingly made of computers. We used to have separate categories of devices. We had, you know, washing machines and VCRs and phones and cars, and now we just have computers in different boxes. A car is just a computer that we put our body in. A 747 is a flying Solaris box full of SCADA controllers. Hearing aids and pacemakers and other prostheses are just computers that we put inside our body. And that means that all of our socio-political problems in the future are going to have a computer inside them. And that means that we'll always, forevermore, have regulators saying, make it so that self-driving cars can't be programmed to drag race, or make it so that bioscale assemblers can't make harmful organisms or restricted compounds in Schedule I narcotics. That is, make me a general-purpose computer that runs every program except for one program that pisses me off, the mythical Turing Complete minus one computer. We don't know how to make computers that can run all the programs we can compile except for the one that pisses off a regulator or disrupts a business model or abets a criminal. The closest approximation we have for that device is a computer with spyware on it out of the box. Computers that watch everything we do in case we do the wrong thing, and then it intercedes and says, I can't let you do that, Dave. A computer that runs secret programs designed to be hidden from the owner of the device, which the device can't override, which the owner can't override or kill, DRM, in other words. These computers are a bad idea for two significant reasons, or at least two that I can think of. The first one is that they don't solve problems. Breaking DRM is not hard for bad guys. The copyright war's lesson is that DRM is always broken with near immediacy. Because DRM only works if the I can't let you do that, Dave, program remains a secret. Once the most sophisticated attackers in the world liberate that secret, it's available to everyone else too. The second reason is that DRM has inherently weak security and makes all of our security overall more weak. Certainty about what software is on your computer is fundamental to good computer security. If you're not allowed to know what software is running on your computer, then you can't make it secure. Designing the I can't let you do that, Dave, facility into computers creates an enormous vulnerability that anyone who hijacks that facility can do things to your computer that you can't find out about, much less override. And once a government has solved a problem with DRM, there's this perverse incentive to make it illegal to tell people things that might undermine the DRM. Things like, this is how DRM works. Or there's a flaw in this DRM that would let an attacker secretly switch out your webcam and listen through your mic. I've had a lot of feedback from various distinguished computer scientists, technologists, civil libertarians, and security researchers after this talk, and I believe that within those fields, within the field of people who agree broadly that owners should be allowed to control what runs on their device, there is a widespread consensus that all things being equal, computers are more secure, and society is better served when the owners of computers can control what software runs on them. But let's examine for a moment what that would actually mean, how you design computers so that owners know what's running on them. Most computers today are fitted with TPMs, Trusted Platform Modules. This is a secure coprocessor mounted on the motherboard, and the specification of these TPMs are published, and an industry body certifies compliance with those specifications. To the extent that this industry body is doing its job and that the spec is good, it's possible to be reasonably certain that you have a real functional TPM inside your computer that faithfully implements the spec. The TPM is secure in that it contains some secrets, cryptographic keys. And it's also secure in that it's designed to be tamper evident. If you try and extract keys from a TPM or remove the TPM from a computer and replace it with a gimmicked one, it should be very obvious to the computer's owner that something has happened. Now, one TPM threat model is that a crook or a government or a police force or some other adversary might try to compromise your computer. Tamper evidence lets you know when your TPM has been fiddled with. Another TPM threat model is that a piece of malicious code will infect your computer. Once your computer is compromised in this way, you could be in great trouble because, after all of the sensors attached to the computer, the mic, the camera, the accelerometer, the fingerprint reader, the GPS, and so on, could be switched on without your knowledge, and the data could be cached or sent on to a bad guy or both. all the data on your computer, your sensitive files, your stored passwords, your web history, might be sent to a bad guy or erased or tampered with. All the keystrokes on your computer, including your passwords, could be logged. And all the peripherals attached to your computer might be covertly operated. Printers, scanners, SCADA controllers, MRI machines, cars, avionics, and 3D printers. Or they could be subtly altered to cause some failure in the future. And other peripherals in the today and in the near future include your optic nerve, your cochlea, the stumps of your legs, and so on. When your computer boots up, the idea is that your TPM asks the bootloader for a signed hash of itself and verifies that the signature from the hash comes from a trusted party. Once you trust the bootloader to faithfully perform its duties, you can ask it to check the signatures in the operating system and then ask the operating system to verify the signatures on your programs and so on, ensuring that you know which programs are running on your computer and that any programs running in secret have managed that trick by leveraging a defect in the bootloader, operating system, or other components, and not because a new defect has been inserted into your system to create a facility for hiding things from you. This always reminds me of Descartes. You know, he starts off by saying that he can't tell what's true and what's not because he's not sure if he really exists and whether his senses are faithful. He finds a way of proving that he exists and that he can trust his senses and that his faculty for reason. And having found that tiny nub of certainty, that thing that he knows that he exists and that his reason is good, he can build an entire stable edifice that he can hang the entire theory of the world off of. Now, that TPM is like that nub of stable certainty. If it's there, it can reasonably inform you about the code on your computer and be reliable in doing so. Now, you may find it weird to hear someone like me talking warmly about TPMs. After all, TPMs are the technologies that make it possible to lock phones, tablets, consoles, and even some PCs so that they can't run software of their owner's choosing. Jailbreaking usually means finding some way to subvert or disable a TPM. Now, why on earth would I want TPMs in my computers? As with everything important, the devil is in the details. Imagine for a moment two different ways of implementing TPMs. The first is lockdown. In a lockdown scenario, your TPM comes with a set of signing keys that it trusts. And unless your bootloader is signed by a TPM-trusted party, you can't run it. And since the bootloader determines what OS launches, you don't get to control your software on your machine. But the second mode is certainty. You tell your TPM which signing keys you trust. So you trust them from Canonical, EFF, ACLU, and WikiLeaks. And it tells you whether or not the bootloaders it can find on your computer have been signed by any of those parties. It can faithfully report the signature on any other bootloaders it finds, and it lets you make up your own goddamn mind about whether you want to trust any or all of the above. Approximately speaking, these two scenarios correspond to the way that iOS and Android work. iOS only lets you run the Apple-approved code. Android lets you tick a box to choose the code that you want. But critically, Android lacks an important facility. It can't do the little bit of crypto work necessary on the software before boot time to tell you whether or not the code you think you're running is actually the code you are running. It's freedom without certainty. Now, in a world where the computers that we're discussing can see you and hear you, where we insert our bodies into them when they fly our planes and drive our cars, where they're surgically implanted inside us, certainty becomes a very big deal. Which is why I like the idea of a TPM, assuming that it's implemented in that certainty mode and not in the lockdown mode. Now, if that's not clear, think of it this way. The war on general purpose computing is what happens when the control freaks in government and industry demand the ability to remotely control our computers. The defenders against that attack are also control freaks. They're like me. But we happen to believe that that device owners should have control over our computers and not governments or corporations. Both sides want control, but they differ on which side should have control. Now, control requires knowledge. If you want to be sure that songs can only be moved onto an iPod and not off of the iPod needs to know that the instructions being given to it by the PC to which it's tethered are emanating from Apple-originated iTunes and not from something that impersonates iTunes in order to get the iPod to give it access to those files. That's how you accomplish the Roach Motel. Now, if you want to be sure that, if I want to be sure that my PVR won't record watch once video on demand movies that I've just paid for, the PVR manufacturer needs to be able to ensure that the tuner that's receiving the video will only talk to approved devices whose manufacturers have promised to honor the do not record flags in the programs. Now, if I want to be sure that you aren't watching me through my webcam, I need to know that I need to know what the drivers are and whether they honor the convention that the little green activity light always comes on when the webcam is running. And if I want to be sure that you aren't capturing my passwords through my keyboard, I need to know that the OS isn't lying when it says that there aren't any software keyloggers on my system. Whether you want to be free or want to enslave, you need to have control and you need to have knowledge. And that's the coming war on general-purpose computers. Now, what I want to investigate today and for the rest of this talk is what happens after we win the war on general-purpose computers, a prospect I call the coming civil war over general-purpose computers. Now, I ask you now to stipulate that we have a victory for the freedom side in the war on general-purpose computing, and that results in computers that lets their owners know what's running on them. Because the computers would faithfully report the hash and associated signatures for their bootloaders, and then the owners could control what was running on their computers, because the computers would allow their owners to specify who was allowed to sign the bootloaders, the OS, and so on. Victory in the war. Now, there are two arguments that we can make for why that would be a good outcome. The first one is the human rights argument. If your world is made of computers, then designing computers to override their owners' decisions has significant human rights implications. Today we worry that the Iranian government might demand import controls on computers so that only those capable of spying on people are operated inside its borders. Tomorrow we might worry about whether or not the British government, notorious control freaks, would demand that when the NHS funds your cochlear implants, that they're designed so that they can't hear extremist speech, or that they log it and report it, or both. Now that's the first argument, human rights. The second argument is the property rights argument. Now, we like the doctrine of first sale. It's an important piece of consumer law. It says that once you buy something, it belongs to you, and you should have the freedom to do anything you want with it, even if that hurts the vendor's interests. DRM opponents like me, we like saying, if you bought it, you own it. Property rights are an incredibly powerful argument to have on your side, especially in America, where strong property rights enforcement are seen as the foundation of all social remedies. This goes double for Silicon Valley, where you can't swing a cat without hitting a libertarian who believes that the major or only role for government is to enforce property rights and the contracts around them. Which is to say that if you want to win a nerd fight, property rights are a powerful weapon to have in your arsenal. And not just nerd fights, policy fights too. That's why copy fighters hate the term intellectual property, this being a synthetic, ideologically loaded tune popularized in the 1970s as a replacement for regulatory monopolies, which is what we used to call intellectual property. It's a lot easier to convince a government that your property needs defending than that your monopoly isn't big enough or expansive enough. Now, this is where the Civil War part comes in. Human rights and property rights both demand that computers not be designed for remote control from governments and corporations and so on. That is, that owners should be allowed to specify what OS they're going to run, to freely choose the nub of certainty from which they will suspend the scaffold of their computer's security. Remember that security is relative. You are secured from attacks on your ability to freely use your music if you can control your computing environment, which erodes the music industry's security to charge rent on a use-by-use basis for your purchased music. If you get to choose the nub from which the scaffold will dangle, you get control and the power to secure yourself against attackers. If the Recording Industry Association of America or the government or Monsanto get to choose the nub, they get to control and they get the power to secure themselves against you. So we all agree that at the very least, owners should be able to know and control what happens on their computers. But what about users? Users of computers don't always have the same interests as owners of computers. And increasingly, we will all be users of computers that we don't own. Now, where you come down on the conflicts between owners and users of computers will end up being one of the most meaningful ideological questions in technology's history. And there's no easy answer I know of for guiding these decisions. I'm going to spoiler my own talk. Usually my talks end with calls to action. Here's what we should do next. This talk doesn't have that because I don't know what to do next, which is why I'm presenting it to this audience, because I hope you'll have some ideas. Now, let's start with a position we'll call property maximalism. If it's my computer, I should have the absolute right to dictate the terms of use to anyone who wants to use it. If you don't like my terms, don't use my computer. Find someone else's. Now, how would that work in practice? We'd use some combination of initialization routine, tamper evidence, law, and physical control. For example, when you turn on your computer for the first time, you might initialize a good secret password, possibly signed by your private key. Now, without that key or password, no one is allowed to change the list of trusted parties from which your computer's TPM will accept bootloaders. And we could make it against the law to subvert this system for the purposes of booting operating systems that the device's owner has not approved. That would be a pretty cool law in some ways. It would make spyware incredibly illegal, and it would also ban secret initialization of DRM. We could design the TPM so that if you remove it or tamper with it, it's really obvious. Give it a fragile housing, for example, that's hard to replace after the time of manufacture, so that it's really obvious to a computer's owner if someone has modified the device, possibly putting it in an unknown and untrustworthy state. And we could add some kind of additional security to the computer's housing, strong physical locks and human guards and so on. Now, I can see a lot of benefits from this, but there are unquestionably downsides as well. Think for a moment about self-driving cars. There are a lot of these around, of course. They come out of Google and elsewhere, and it's easy to understand how, on the one hand, self-driving cars would be incredibly awesome. After all, we are, collectively as a species, terrible drivers. Cars kill the shit out of us. Seriously, it's the number one cause of death in America for people aged 5 to 34. Now, I've been hit by a car, and I've also cracked up a car, and I'm willing to stipulate that I have no business behind the wheel. It's also easy to understand how we might be nervous about people homebrewing their own self-driving car firmware. On the one hand, we'd want the source for all of our cars to be open so that we could subject it to rigorous scrutiny and make sure that it's doing what it says it does and is as free from flaws and defects as it can be. And on the other hand, though, it would be plausible to say cars are safer if they use a locked bootloader that only trusts government-certified firmware that comes from the Department of Motor Vehicles. And now we're back to whether or not you get to decide whether your computer is doing what you want it to do. Now, there are a couple of problems with this solution of locking car firmware. The first one, of course, is that it won't work. It won't work for the same reason that DRM doesn't work in the copyright wars. Firmware locks are just not effective against determined adversaries. People who want to sow some mayhem with their custom firmware will always be able to. What's more, this is not a good security approach. If vehicular security models depend on all other vehicles being well-behaved and no unexpected behaviors arising, we are all dead meat. Self-driving cars must be conservative in their approach to their own conduct and liberal in their expectation of other people's conduct. This is the same advice you got on day one of driver's ed, and it's good advice whether you're driving the car or the computer is driving the car. But there's another problem with it. It's a wider social problem, and it's that this solution of locking car firmware invites some very sticky and ugly parallels. Remember the old days when we talked about the information superhighway, and you heard lots of people from the record and movie industry talking about driver's licenses for the information superhighway? If we can justify securing our physical roads by demanding that the state or a state-like entity gets to certify the firmware of the devices that cruise on its lanes, how could we articulate a policy explaining why the devices on our equally vital metaphorical roads with comparable firmware locks for PCs, tablets, and other devices should not be controlled by the government as well? After all, the general purpose network means that MRIs, spaceships, air traffic control systems, and so on all share a single information superhighway with Game Boys, Arduino-linked fart machines, and dodgy voyeur cams sold by spammers who make them in the Pearl River Delta. And consider avionics and power station automation. This is an even trickier one. If the FAA mandates a certain firmware for 747s, it's probably going to want those 747s designed so that only the FAA can choose what bootloader runs on the 747. And just as the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and just in the same way that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission will want the final say on the firmware for your reactor pile. Now, this will be a same, this may be a problem for the same reason that a ban on modifying car firmware is. It establishes the idea that allowing the authorities to control your software load is a good way to solve our social problems. But it may be, that airplanes and nukes are already so regulated that an additional layer of software regulation wouldn't leak out into other areas of daily life. Nukes and planes are subject to an extraordinary amount of no-notice inspection and reporting requirements that are genuinely unique to their circumstances. But there's a bigger problem with this owner control market. What about the people who only use computers and not the people who own computers? This is not a group of people whom the IT industry has a lot of sympathy for on the whole. An enormous amount of energy has been devoted to stopping non-owning users from inadvertently breaking the computers they're using by downloading menu bars, typing random shit they find on the internet into their terminals, plugging in malware-infected USB devices, disabling the firewall, installing plugins, adding repositories, adding certificates to the machine's or browser's trust root, punching holes in the network perimeter by accident, accidentally connecting networks that are required to remain separate, such as the sensitive internal network and the untrusted external network, and to stop users from deliberately doing bad things like installing keyloggers and spyware to attack future users, misappropriating secrets, snooping on the network traffic, deliberately breaking their machines, deliberately punching holes in the network perimeter, deliberately disabling the firewall, and deliberately interconnecting networks that are supposed to remain separate. There's a kind of symmetry here. DRM and its cousins are deployed by people who believe that you can't and shouldn't be trusted to set policy on the computer that you own. If systems are deployed by IT systems are deployed by computer owners who believe that computer users can't be trusted to set policy on the computers they use. As a former systems administrator and CIO, I'm not going to pretend that users aren't a challenge. But I think that there are good reasons to treat users as having rights to set policy on the computers that they don't own. I want to start with an easy one, that what I think of as the simple one, which is the business case. Because human rights are always harder to explain than profit. In America, of course, money talks and bullshit walks. When we demand freedom for owners, we do so for a lot of reasons. But one important one is that computer programmers can't anticipate all of the contingencies that their code might run up against. That when the computer says yes, you might still need to say no. And when the computer says no, you, the owner, might still need to say yes. The idea that owners possess local situational awareness that cannot be perfectly captured in any number of nested if-then statements. This is where communism and libertarianism ironically converge. Now, this guy, Friedrich Hayek, who's kind of the archduke of capitalist thought, believed that expertise was diffuse and that you were more likely to find the situational awareness necessary for good decision-making very close to the decision itself. Devolution gives better results than centralization. And then there's this guy. Marx believed that in the legitimacy of workers' claims over their working environment, saying that the contribution of labor was just as important as the contribution of capital, and demanded that workers be treated as the rightful owners of their workplace with the power to set policy there. For totally opposite reasons, both of these guys believe that the people at the coalface should be given as much power as possible. The death of mainframes was attended by an awful lot of concern over users and what they might do in the enterprise. In those days, users were even more constrained than they are today. They could only see the screens that the mainframe let them see and only undertake the operations that the mainframe let them undertake. When the PC and VisiCalc and Lotus 123 appeared, employees actually risked being fired by bringing these machines into the office or bringing home office data to use on these machines because they had a computing need that couldn't be met within the constraints set by their company and its IT department. And because they didn't think that the legitimacy of their needs would be recognized, the standard response to any such request is usually, our regulatory compliance prohibits you from computing the way that you need to do your job, or if you do your job that way, we won't be able to make sure that you've done it right, or you only think that you want to do your job that way, or it's impossible to make computers do what you think that you need them to do, or simply our corporate policy prohibits this. Now, some or all of these reasons might be true, though often they aren't. And even when they are true, they're the kind of soft truths that we give bright young geeks millions of dollars in venture capital to falsify, while middle-aged administrative assistants get written up by HR for trying to do the same thing. The personal computer arrived in the enterprise through the back door, over the objections of IT, without the knowledge of management, at the risk of censure and termination, and it made the companies that fought it billions, trillions. The reason that giving workers more powerful, more flexible tools was good for their companies is that people are generally smart and they generally want to do their jobs. And because they all know stuff that their bosses don't know. As an owner, you don't want the devices you buy locked because you might want to do something that the designer didn't anticipate. And employees don't want the devices they use all day locked because they might want to do something that the IT department didn't anticipate. This is the soul of Hayekism and of the free market, that we're smarter at the edge than we are in the middle. Now, the business world pays a lot of lip service to Hayek's 1940s ideas about free markets. But when it comes to freedom within the companies that they run, they're stuck a good 50 years earlier, mired in the ideology of a guy named Frederick Winslow Taylor and his scientific management. Now, he had the idea that workers were just particularly unreliable kinds of machines whose movements and actions should be scripted and constrained by all-knowing management consultants who would work with the equally wise company bosses to determine the one true way to do their job best. In other words, the ideology that let Toyota cream Detroit's Big Three during the car wars in the 1980s. So, letting enterprise users do stuff that they think will allow them to make more money for their companies sometimes makes their companies more money. And also, scientific management is about as scientific as trepanation, or Myers-Briggs tests. The business case for user rights is a good one, but I really just wanted to get it out of the way so that I could get down to the real meat of this talk. The human rights dimension of user rights. Now, this may seem a little weird on its face, but bear with me. This is a guy named Hugh Hare. Earlier this year, I saw a talk by him. He's the director of the Biomechatronics Group at the MIT Media Lab. Some of you have probably seen him do a talk. He's got some TED Talks on YouTube. It's electrifying. Now, he starts out by showing a bunch of slides of cool prostheses that they're building in the lab, you know, legs and feet and hands and arms. They use focused magnetism to suppress activity in the brains of people with untreatable severe depression to an amazing effect. And then he shows this slide. This is a slide of him climbing a mountain, and you can see that he's buff and he's clinging to the rocks like a gecko, and it's pretty awesome. And then you see the whole slide. He doesn't have any legs. He's just got these cool mountain climbing prostheses. He looks down at the audience from where he's been standing and walking around on the stage the whole time, and he says, "Oh yeah, didn't I mention that? I'm robot from the knee down." And he pulls up his trousers. And then he proceeds to run up and down the stage like a mountain goat. It's one of the most amazing things you've ever seen. Now, the first question, when I saw him speak, the first question anybody asked was, how much do these cost? And he named a price that would buy you a nice brownstone in central Manhattan or a terraced Victorian in Zone 1 in London. So the second question anyone asked was, well, who's going to be able to afford these? And he answered, why? Everyone, of course. If you have to choose between a 40-year mortgage or legs, you'll choose the legs every time. Which is all by way of asking you to consider the possibility that there are going to be people, potentially a lot of people, potentially you, who are users of computers that they don't own, where those computers are going to be part of their bodies. Now, I think most of the technology world can understand why you, as the owner of your cochlear implants, should be legally allowed to choose what firmware runs on them. After all, when you own a device that is surgically implanted in your skull, it makes a lot of sense to give you the freedom to choose your software vendor. Maybe the company that made your implant had the very best signal processing algorithm when they were inserted into your head. But what happens when a competitor gets a superior algorithm next year? Should you be doomed to inferior hearing for the rest of your life or for the life of that competitor's patent? This is a problem that can't be overcome by mere code escrow and publication. That's the sort of thing that would protect you if the company that made your ears went bankrupt. You need to have the freedom to choose. Code publication won't do it. That code publication only protects you from sloppy or sneaky code that lets bad guys do bad things to your hearing. Now, this is a problem that only is overcome by the ambiguous right to change the software, even if the company that made your implants is still a going concern. So that's great if you're the owner of your cochlear implants. But what about users of cochlear implants? Consider the following scenarios. Say you're the minor child of deeply religious parents who pay for your cochlear implants, and they ask for the software that makes it impossible for you to hear blasphemy. Do you have the right to change your software load? Or you're broke, and a commercial company wants to sell you ad-supported implants that listen in on your conversations and insert contextual ads that trigger discussions about the brands that you love. Or your government is willing to install cochlear implants, but they want to archive and review everything that you hear without your knowledge or consent. Is that far-fetched? Well, last month, the Canadian Border Agency was forced to abandon its plans to fill Canada's airports with hidden high-fidelity microphones that would listen in and log every single conversation in the airports. Will the Iranian government or the Chinese government take advantage of this if they can do so? Now, speaking of Iran and China, there are plenty of human rights activists who believe that bootlocking is the start of a human rights disaster. It's no secret that there are high-tech companies that have been happy to build lawful intercept backdoors into their equipment to allow for warrantless secret access to your communications. These backdoors are now standard, and so even if your country doesn't want that capability, it will still be there. Now, in Greece, there's no legal requirement to have lawful interception backdoors on telecoms equipment. But during the 2004-2005 Olympic bidding process, an unknown person or agency switched on the dormant lawful intercept capacity in the country's phone switches and captured a large amount of private communication from the highest levels and then switched that capacity off again. Surveillance in the middle of the network is nowhere near as exciting as surveillance at the edge of the network might be, whether that edge of the network is in your ear or in your laptop. As the ghosts of Mr. Hayek and Marx will tell you, there's a lot of interesting stuff happening at the coalface that never makes it back to the central office. Even so-called democratic governments know this. That's why the Bavarian government illegally installed this Bundestrojaner, state Trojan, on people's computers, gaining access to their files and keystrokes and much else besides. It's a safe bet that totalitarian governments will happily take advantage of bootlocking and move the surveillance right into the box. You may not import a computer into Iran unless you limit its trust model so that it only boots up operating systems with lawful intercept backdoors built right into the machine. Now, assume that we get the user control model, where the first person to use a machine gets to initialize a list of trusted keys and then lock it with a secret or some other authorization token. All this means is that the state's customs agents have to unbox every computer and initialize it with the state's key. Now, maybe you'll be able to do something that overrides that trust model, but by design, this system will be heavily tamper-evident, meaning that a secret policeman or an informant can tell at a glance whether you've locked the state out of your system. And it's not just repressive states, of course. Remember that there are four major customers for existing censorware, spyware, lockware, and surveillance. There's repressive governments, there's large corporations, and then there's schools. And finally, paranoid parents. That is to say, the technical needs of helicopter parents, school systems, and enterprises are convergent with the governments of Syria and China. They may not have the same ideological ends, but they have awfully similar technological means to achieve their individual ends. We are very forgiving of these institutions as they pursue their ends. You can do almost anything if you say that you're protecting shareholders or children. For example, you may remember that there was widespread indignation from all sides when it was revealed that some companies were requiring prospective employees to hand over their Facebook login credentials as a condition of employment. Those employers argued that they needed to be able to review your list of friends and what you said to them in private before determining whether or not you were suitable for employment. Facebook logins were fast becoming the workplace urine testing of the 21st century. A means of ensuring that your private life doesn't have any unsavory secrets lurking in it, secrets that might compromise your working life. Now, the nation wasn't buying this. As soon as the story broke, Senate hearings and editorials, the whole country rose up against the idea of Facebook logins for prospective employees. But no one seems to mind that many employers routinely add their own intermediate keys into their employees' devices, their phones, their tablets, and their computers. This allows them to spy on your internet traffic even when it's secure, with TLS and a lock showing up in your browser. It gives your employer access to any and all sensitive data that you access from the job. Whether it's your union's message board, or your bank, or your Gmail account, or your HMO, or your doctor's private patient messaging area, or Facebook. There's a wide consensus that this is okay, because the laptop, phone, and tablet your employer issues to you are not your property, they're the company's property. And yet, the reason employers give us these mobile devices is because there is no longer any meaningful distinction between personal life and working life. Corporate sociologists who study the way that we use our devices find time and again that employees are not capable of maintaining strict divisions between work and personal accounts and devices. America is the land of the 55-hour work week, a country where few professionals take any meaningful vacation time, and when they do get away for a day or two, they do so in the company of their work-issued devices. Even in traditional workplaces, we recognize the human rights of workers. We don't put cameras in the toilets to curtail employee theft. If your spouse came by the office on your lunch break and the two of you went into the parking lot so that she or he could tell you that the doctor says the cancer is terminal, you would be aghast and furious to discover that your employer had been spying on you with a hidden microphone during that conversation. But if you use your company laptop to access Facebook on your lunch break, wherein your spouse conveys to you that the cancer is terminal, the exact same message, you're supposed to be okay with the fact that your employer has been running a man-in-the-middle attack on your machine and now knows the most intimate details of your life. There are plenty of instances in which rich and powerful people, and not just corporate peons and children and prisoners, will be users instead of owners. Every car rental agency would love to be able to lowjack the cars they rent to you. Remember that a car is just a computer you insert your body into. Not to mention that they would love to log all the places you've been to for marketing purposes and analytics. There's money to be made in finagling the GPS in the rental car to ensure that your routes always take you past certain billboards or restaurants. But in general, the poorer and younger you are, the more likely that you are to be a tenant farmer in some feudal lord's computational lands. The more likely that your legs will simply cease to walk if you get behind on payments on them. Meaning that any thug who buys up your debt from a payday lender can literally and legally threaten to take your legs away, or your eyes, or your ears, or your arms, or your insulin, or your pacemaker, if you don't come up with the next payment. Before I discussed how owner override would work, some combination of physical access control and tamper evidence designed to give owners of computers the power to know and control what bootloader and OS was running on their machines. Now, how would a user override work? I think effective user override would have to leave the underlying computer intact, so that when the owner took it back, she could be sure that it was in the state that she believed it to be in. In other words, we need to protect users from owners and owners from users. Here's one model for it, and I say that saying that with the free stipulation that I'm not a cryptographer and not a security expert, in the hopes that some of you will tell me how I'm wrong and how to improve on this idea. Now imagine that there's a bootloader that can reliably and accurately report on the kernels and OSs it finds on the drive. This is a prerequisite for any of these control situations, whether it's the government or corporations controlling how you use your computer, you controlling how you use your computer, or users controlling how they use the computers they use. So one way or another, I believe that we're going to end up with this in our systems. Now, give the bootloader the power to suspend any running OS to disk, encrypting all its threads and parking them. And then the power to select another OS from the network or from some external drive. So I walk into an internet cafe and there's an OS running that I can verify. I can be sure that this is the bootloader that I think it is. And I can see right away that it has a lawful interception backdoor for the police. It stores all my keystrokes, all my files, and all my screens in an encrypted blob that the state can decrypt. Now, say I'm an attorney or a doctor or a corporate executive or just a normal human who doesn't like the idea of his private stuff being available to anyone who's friends with a dirty cop who will decrypt that blob for him. So I do some kind of three-finger salute with the F keys and I drop into a minimal bootloader shell, one that invites me to give the net address of an alternative OS or insert some kind of drive. The cafe owner's operating system is parked. I can't see inside it anymore. But the bootloader can assure me that it is dormant and not spying on me as the OS fires up. And when it's done, all my working files are trashed, and the bootloader confirms that too. Not just because this keeps the computer's owner from spying on me, but because this keeps me from leaving malware that attacks the user's owner. There will be technological means of subverting this, but there is an enormous world of difference between starting from a design spec that aims to protect users from owners and owners from users than one that says that users must always be vulnerable to the owner's dictates. Fundamentally, this is the difference between freedom and openness, between free software and open source. This is where the war between free and open acquires some real shooting munitions. Now, human rights and property rights often come into conflict with each other. For example, in most places, landlords aren't allowed to enter your home without adequate notices. And in many places, hotels can't throw you out if you overstay your reservation, provided that you pay the rack rate posted on the door. Or think of repossession of leased goods, cars, for example. These are limited by procedures that require notice and the opportunity to rebut claims of your delinquent payments. Now, when these laws and procedures about human rights and property rights get streamlined to make them easier for property holders, we often see human rights abuses. Robo-signing eviction mills that use fraudulent declarations to evict homeowners who are caught up on their mortgages or who don't have any mortgage at all. The potential for abuse in a world of computers is much greater. Your car might drive itself back to the repo yard, or your high-rise apartment building's elevators switch themselves off, as do their climate systems, stranding thousands of people until a disputed license payment is settled. This has already happened with multi-level parking garages. Back in 2006, the 314-car robot parking model RPS-1000 garage in Hoboken, New Jersey, took all of their cars and its guts hostage. It locked down the software until the garage's owners paid a disputed license payment. They paid it even though they maintained that they didn't owe it, because what the hell else were they going to do? And what will you do when your dispute with a vendor means that you go blind or deaf or lose the ability to walk or become suicidally depressed? The negotiating leverage that accrues to owners over users is total and terrifying. Users will be strongly incentivized to settle quickly rather than face the dreadful penalties that could be visited on them in the event that they had a dispute with an owner. And when the owner of the device is a state or a state-sized corporate actor, the potential for human rights abuses skyrockets. This is not to say that owner override is an unmitigated evil. Think of the smart meters that can override your thermostat at peak loads. These allow us to switch off coal and other dirty power sources that can be that are varied at peak times. But they work best if the users, the homeowners who've allowed the power company to install them, can't override the meters. What happens, though, when griefers, crooks, or governments try to quell popular rebellion using these meters to turn off heat during a 100-year storm or cranking heat up during a heat wave? The HVAC system in your house can hold the power of life and death over you. Do we really want it designed to allow remote parties to do stuff with it even when you disagree with them? The question is, once we create a design norm of devices that users can't override, how far will it creep? Especially risky would be the use of owner override after payday to offer payday loan style services to vulnerable people. Can't afford artificial eyes for your kids? We'll subsidize them if you let us redirect their focus to sponsored toys and sugar snacks when you go to the store. But foreclosing on owner override probably means that there will be poor people who will not be offered some technology at all. If I can lowjack your legs, I can lease them to you with the confidence that of my power to repo them if you default on your payments. And if I can't, I may choose not to lease you legs at all, unless you've got a lot of money to begin with. But if your legs can decide to walk away to the repo depot without your consent, you would be totally screwed the day that muggers, rapists, griefers, or the secret police figured out how to hijack and own that facility. It gets even more complicated, of course, because you are the user of many systems in the most transitory way, whether those are subway turnstiles, elevators, or the blood pressure cuff at your doctor's office, or a public bus or airplane. It's going to be hard to figure out how to create user overrides that aren't nonsensical, like just because I'm sitting in seat 14A, I get to change the firmware load on the airplane. Though we can start by saying that a user is someone who is the sole user of a device for a meaningful amount of time, although, of course, meaningful is going to be a very contentious issue. This isn't a problem that I know how to solve. Unlike the war on general-purpose computers, the civil war over general-purpose computers seems to present a series of conundra without any obvious, to me, solutions, which is why I'm talking to you about them. These problems may be a long way off, and of course, they'll only arise if we win the war on computers first. But come Victory Day, when we start planning out our constitutional Congress for the new world where regulating computers is acknowledged to be the wrong way to solve social problems, let's not paper over the division between property rights and user rights and human rights. This is the sort of the division that, while it festers, puts the most vulnerable people in our society in harm's way. Agreeing to disagree on this one is no longer good enough. We need to start thinking about the principles that will apply when the day comes. Because if we don't start now, it's going to be too late. Thank you. So I reckon we've got about 10 minutes for Q&A. Is that right, Goons?
Yes?
Yeah? 5 minutes? Yeah. So I know that this is a very abstract talk. It's not a talk I would give to a general audience, but it's one that I hope you folks will have some good feedback on. Go ahead.
So with lobbyists and stuff, the average citizen is totally disenfranchised. What hope do we have in this war?
What hope do we have in the war on general-purpose computing? I think that the hope that we have in the war on general-purpose computing is that we enlist more people to our side just by waiting. Because the number of people for whom computers are not an abstract thing goes up every day, right? It's weird that hackers like hate their grandmothers and their mothers a lot. They always use them as examples of like clueless people. My mom and my grandmother are both very clued in people, but my grandmother was never into computers. She never saw any reason to do so. She types really fast. She was a secretary, but she didn't see any reason to do so until the day I had a kid. And I live in England and my grandmother lives in Canada, and she knew that if she wanted to see her great-granddaughter, she was going to have to learn to use a computer so that we could Skype. All of a sudden, computers became incredibly important to her, and she learned how to use them like that, because that's what you do, right? When there's suddenly a reason to use a computer, you figure out how to use a computer. And for her now, a fight over how an ISP operates, or how competition works in ISPs, or how computers are regulated, or how they're surveilled, or what software she gets to install on her device, all of those questions are now deeply personal. If we can relate any issue about computer policy to her ability to Skype with her great-granddaughter, we can win. We'll get her on side. The number of people for whom the technology per se is not important, but what it does is vital, goes up every single day. And every one of those people are going to be on our side. We just have to hope that things don't get so screwed up between now and when, you know, sort of everybody has the consciousness that this group might have or the EFF has of the underlying role of computers and all these other policy areas. But if we can resist that over screwed up at-ness, we all have an army at our command. So for me, you know, I feel like that's an important fight, and I'm going to keep on fighting it. But I feel like we've all suddenly looked around and we've realized that pretty much everyone agrees that King George is a dick and it's time for a revolution. But we're like, you know, there's this other thing where some of us think property rights is more important than human rights, and some of us think human rights is more important than property rights. Let's agree to disagree on that while we're fighting this war, and maybe we'll just let time sort it out. It'll probably sort itself out. And in fact, it didn't sort itself out. It put a whole population of people in chains and then ended with one of the most grotesque wars ever fought in any country and continues to reverberate through to today. And I kind of feel like if you're at the Constitutional Congress and you showed up having thought about this human rights and property rights question for a few years beforehand, and you've been quietly building consensus that this was an important issue to solve today and not to punt, how much harm could you have averted? So I'd like us to start thinking about it. Next question.
One more.
One more. Okay. Yep.
So since they sort of exposing the Department of
Transportation, So that's a slightly different. The question is, what about the fact that that Facebook's APIs expose a shitload of data that you've never really thought that you consented to give up, or understood that you've consented? I think that's an important issue, but it's not this one. This one is about the fact that we aren't outraged. We are outraged when an employer says to a prospective employee, tell me your login and password, but we're completely cool with it when they just spy on you once you've been hired to get your login and password, or at least your authentication credentials, because they own the computer that you're using to do it. And that, to me, seems like it's no different from saying, well, we're gonna like eavesdrop on all your conversations at work and find out, you know, your bank account number when you tell it to your wife over your cell phone on your lunch break, and we're gonna use that to like look in your bank account. Not steal your money or anything, just look in your bank account. And it seems weird to me that that's cool so long as it involves property rights. And it seems to me that there has to be a human rights limit that pushes back against the absolute nature of property rights. Or I hope so anyway. So I think that's time. Thank you all very much.